can be an extraordinary adventure. More than ordinary. In the gym. At home. At work. More than ordinary. Advice. Without the new agey bullshit.
Welcome to More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm Anne Maria DeMars. And we have here today our guest,
Rich Dixon.
Rich is an expert. He would be too polite to call himself an expert in education, but I will call him that. With 17 years of experience teaching primarily at elementary school, he also has taught for many years in teacher preparation programs. And as well as being a teacher and consumer of educational technology, he is a producer of it. And one of the things we wanted to talk to him about today was badging, because some of you may be familiar with the idea of badges or micro-credentials, or maybe not. So we brought in someone who is an expert. So Rich, could you just start out by telling us a little bit about what micro-credentials are, or badging as you would define it?
You bet. A micro-credential or digital badge is a graphic that when you click on it, pulls up a list of descriptions around what a learner has accomplished. Maybe some objectives, maybe how that learning lined up to different academic or non-academic standards, when it was issued, if there's an expiration date, an optional link out to see that evidence that the learner submitted to earn the badge. So it could be a video, it could be a written document, it could be a voiceover narrative, a screen capture, something like that. The bottom line is that a digital badge is a representation of knowledge that allows the earner more granular control of how they represent themselves personally and professionally.
So, for example, I'm looking for a graphic artist. So I could go and find that, you know, Billy Bob has on his resume or on his webpage, I'm a graphic artist, and he has these list of badges he's earned in Photoshop. So I could click on his Making Gifts badge, and it would show me that he had made these gifts, and then it would say a little bit about what he had done to earn this badge. Is that kind of it?
That's correct. So all of that data that comes up after you click on the badge is called metadata. And that metadata is embedded with a variety of different options. So it could include not only things I listed there, but whether or not it was earned with university credit attached, background about who issued it, was it a formal institution or was it not? And it would provide you what's called the inspector or consumer, the viewer of that digital badge, really great insight into not only what they did, but through that evidence of learning how they did it, in order to gain trust with the person about what they can actually do. So it goes more than just a simple paper certificate, as you and I might know it. So let me give you an example. One of the problems that digital badging is trying to solve is providing more information actually has been on a paper certificate. A paper certificate might list when it was issued and the organization or authority that was issuing the certificate, maybe a broad general description about the title of the course or skill set, but that's about it. It could be forged easily, doesn't really tell me exactly how it was learned, doesn't even tell me how that person's skills were assessed or validated. And as a result, we have to trust a lot. There's a lot left between the lines to infer. A digital badge, on the other hand, attempts to take that ambiguity away. So let's say, for example, that I earned a badge on making gifts, as you said, and through a graphic design course that was offered, say, by a formal institution, I have a portfolio that I've linked to within that metadata. I can attach that to a resume, to an email signature, or other digital means like a webpage or a blog, and have a potential employer or co-collaborator, or the public in general, have access to that digital credential. So when they click on it, again, they have a valid way to be able to see with a high level of trust what my skills are related to that particular claim. So in other words, we're trying to bridge between claim and verification of the skill sets that are claimed within traditional certification programs. I was going to say another important thing to consider as well is that oftentimes our skill sets that we acquire are very specific in nature, but are represented by certificates or graduation diplomas in a very generalized way. So again, breaking down graphic design and that discipline as an example, there are a number of different subsets, understanding typography, for example, or understanding color, or understanding other things that I'm not well versed in because I'm not a graphic design specialist. With digital badges, they're set up to represent very distinct skill sets. They can also represent very broad things, but their power really comes in the best form when they have very specific skills they're referring to, and then show how those skill sets were put into practice. So that's another benefit of using the digital badge format.
I could see as an employer how it could be helpful to me, because someone comes in, they have a degree in statistics or computer science, and you can't know every university in the world. And even if they come from someplace fairly well known, as you said, you kind of have to take it on faith that, say, they did the work themselves. And what I'm really interested in is not what your degree is, but say, can you write code? Can you write something where you use functions, where you have some logic, where you have if-then statements, where you integrate with code from other people? And so I could see how I could look at somebody and say, okay, they have a badge in JavaScript. So that could mean anything. But if I can go in and look at some of the things that they created, but then that brings me to the question of how do you know, as an employer or the person giving the badge or whatever, how do I know that that person actually did it, that they didn't just copy it off of Stack Overflow?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's two points to it. One of the growing edges within digital badges is that trustworthiness or validation, so that there's a sense of currency or value around those claims. And I think there's two things within the digital badge specification, the technical spec, that allow for that trust to occur. Number one is that there's an option for the issuer of that badge to have a validation claim, which links out to either an email address, so someone can email to ask about the verification of the claims, and or a website that provides a certificate of trust, much like we might find if we were to click on a badge at the bottom of a web page around the veracity of an SSL cert when making a purchase online. And we have a claim that we're trying to verify that way. So there's two different ways that that's happening right now. And there's a whole nother level as well. Coming soon is a whole kind of esoteric topic around badge chain. And badge chain takes its inspiration from blockchain. And if you're not familiar with blockchain, you're probably familiar with Bitcoin, the digital currency that uses a public ledger where bits of information about the currency online, the virtual currency, is distributed amongst servers worldwide. And it's very, very difficult to be able to forge that currency, which is what makes Bitcoin an intriguing technology, emerging technology. And that same concept is now being applied to what will be the next generation of the badge specification by embedding unique codes that are open to the public, but distributed amongst a number of different servers, so that one particular badge, if you clicked on the verification of the trustworthiness of that badge through a link inside the metadata, it would then go and check against all the different public servers to ensure that there is nothing fishy going on, that no one's duplicated that particular badge. And because that badge verification of blockchain isn't served out on one computer, one server, it's distributed throughout the world, it provides a much more difficult challenge to forge and duplicate. So those are just some very high-level, broad examples of how the trustworthiness or currency of a digital badge is being built today.
And I have a question for you, because we've had a lot of people on the podcast who talk about a variety of things. And you can tell when you're talking to someone whether they're passionate about it and just their voice. And you seem very, very passionate about this. And I'm wondering, how did that interest get started? How did you get into this badging and, you know, from being a teacher? But where did that interest come from?
It's a great question. I'm very passionate about equity issues within education. And you may think, digital badges and equity, how do they go hand in hand? But I think as I look at instructional design as an educator and how helping learners discover their gifts, be able to acquire skills, knowledge, and experience, and then being able to communicate out to the broader world about their unique skill sets that open up doors for additional education opportunities, employment, or just life interest pursuits, hobbies, if you will, I began to realize that we within education, and I shoulder that burden myself as part of it, don't do a great job of setting up students and adult learners for that matter with success in being able to effectively communicate their value. And let me give you a more tangible example. For years, I've worked with training educators, K-12 educators, on different skill sets that apply to their classroom. And somewhere along the last 25 years, I realized that a lot of the skill sets that were being taught were valued and understood by the people in that room where the learning was taking place on a full day, in-person, synchronous, live training day. But people outside of that school and in the district may or may not value that same thing. And certainly not when a teacher went to try to communicate that to, say, a future employer if they were exiting the teaching program. And it often, I found, as I was watching veteran teachers who didn't want to continue teaching from cradle to grave, so to speak, from the time they got their degree until retirement, if they started early in their life, they were having a really hard time making that transition. They were having a hard time imagining what they could do that was of any value to them beyond their own teaching. And I knew that that wasn't the case. Educators spend a lot of time teaching themselves informally, as well as attending a lot of professional development and formal training. And then concurrently, I also saw a challenge with students. Students that will, if you allow me to use this term, were quote unquote non-traditional. They weren't necessarily going to be going to a four-year degree program, either because of finances or because of other means. But those students oftentimes had amazing challenges. And I'll give you a quick example, or amazing skills. So one student I had that lived in a fairly rural area north of Seattle when I was starting to teach was teaching himself all about C++ coding. This is in the early 90s. And he was a fifth grader. His parents had not gone to college. His parents were both loggers, blue-collar workers. He didn't necessarily have, based off of his own parents' admission, much of a chance at going to college. Their income didn't allow it. They themselves had been second-generation blue-collar workers in that area. And they figured their son would probably enter the same profession that they had. What I noticed, though, with my student is that his obsession, if you will, with getting good at coding at that age and time, this is about 1995, he didn't have a way to cleanly articulate that skill for potential internships and open up job opportunities. He could tell people, he could share that with them if they called him in, but he didn't have a clean way of doing that to the same degree that digital badges allow. And so I've kind of held both the needs of professionals that might want to move into a different position within a district or different districts, move on to a different district, or even to a different profession close in my mind through this whole journey into digital badging and trying to solve a problem on how we can recognize and validate that recognition of knowledge for them. And then also for students. And I think for students that, for example, spend a lot of time working on music at home and creating different mixes of music and creating their own music, may not have the same representation of those skill sets on a traditional school diploma for sure, or transcript, but yet they have very valuable skills that their community values, that they value, and would be informative to a future employer around how they acquired those skills and even if they applied them successfully. So for me, equity for students is a big passion of mine, and I think it really opens up doors for, again, quote unquote, non-traditional learners. And then for educators, taking those skill sets and transitioning away from education, as I myself have done, has been a harder challenge. I've been fortunate myself to not have some of the challenges that I've seen some of my friends go through. So I think it was for both those areas and reasons why I got into digital badging.
Well, and you know, to some people listening, that might sound like a crazy idea that, oh, this kid's going to do something outside of school and they're going to get credit for it somehow. But really, at least within sports, that's been around in a lot of the districts for many years. One of my daughters was on the Olympic team. A lot of her friends were international athletes when they were in high school. Yeah. And I think Rhonda was even winning a lot of junior championships in middle school. And you can go to the district and you can have the coach fill out some form that says this student trains this many hours a week in this Olympic sport.
Yes.
And they can get credit for PE, which for those kids is a big advantage, a lot of them, because they're spending so many hours in their sport. They could, like what Rhonda did, she used that extra hour for study hall. So yeah, there is precedent for that. And what you're making me think of is, well, if that student is studying music outside of class, why can't they get that credit for their music class? Or if they're studying coding outside, why can't they get credit? And I just never really put it together like that, but it makes perfect sense.
Oh, I think those are great, great examples. And I know my own personal life, my own daughter, who had an interest in graphic design, and she took an introductory course through a traditional high school, but she wanted to continue that on. And so she was able to find on her own, and all credit to her for this, an internship, which then turned into a paid job. And she's been documenting the skills that she's been picking up with the idea that she has a collection of very discrete skills that she can represent through something like digital badges for future employers or interest areas in which she grows. So lots of really interesting case studies that have emerged. And there's an organization I'd like to mention called, it has the following letters. It's an acronym, LRNG. And they have been doing great work with secondary students in inner city situations to help recognize accomplishments and then connect those accomplishments to employers in those cities like Chicago that will accept those digital badges as entry points to either provide guaranteed interviews for jobs or to help students and young adults, even if they're finished with school, be able to start slightly up on the pay scale or even open up jobs that might not have normally been available to them. In other words, it helps distinguish who they are as learners.
And you mentioned, you know, making the transition from teaching to a different field. And how was that for you? You were saying it wasn't that difficult of a transition, or was maybe less difficult than some other people you know. How did you make that transition? What made you decide to do that? And why do you think it was maybe a little bit less of a rocky transition for you than it is for some other people?
I think for me, I had spent a number of years acknowledging the fact that I probably would not continue on education within a traditional teaching, classroom teaching position forever. And I'll give you a reason why. I started teaching in the classroom at age 21. And through quick mathematical calculations, I realized that would be 44 years in the classroom. And I used to joke that that would be a crime against humanity. So I went into the profession knowing at some point I would probably exit and wanted to give it my very best and all my energy. And at about year 17, I started to have other opportunities. I launched a nonprofit, for example, during that time period. I worked on the corporate side for training for a couple years, and then found myself with the opportunity to grow and build a company around professional development for K-12 teachers, connecting me full circle back with my roots, but building upon skill sets that I acquired during my years as a teacher and then also as someone who delivered professional development. So I think for me, with teaching, the transition happened partly because of mindset, not that I was ever looking to go to jump out, but I also knew that I would need to push myself to acquire skills in the area of technology and even early level basic business skills to help with whatever may come down the road, because it benefited me as a teacher and as an administrator during my career, and certainly helped as I was making a transition away. But not every single educator goes into the profession thinking that, and it can make that transition very challenging as a result.
So you kind of went in with the idea that I'm not going to be doing this forever.
Yeah, at least not traditional classroom teacher. And not that I wouldn't leave and necessarily, you know, I could come back to it at some point. I've always left the door open for that, because at the end of the day, my passion is still working on equity issues and helping students to be able to self-actualize their skills and talents and open up new doors that they might not normally be able to access without some creative opportunities presented to themselves. And that still drives me in the work that I do today. But yeah, to answer your question, I certainly left room to leave because, again, as I watched veteran teachers, very few that I saw that could make a 40-plus year career and still stay as excited, passionate about their work as I wanted to be able to provide for the students and families that I served.
Yeah, I know very few people like that, and they're amazing, but there's very few of them.
Yeah.
Well, you're a weirdo. And Maria's a weirdo too. And I want to say this. Tom Peters, in one of his talks I heard, said that the secret to success is you find a fellow freak far away, because he says there's somebody else as crazy as you. But
yeah.
The reason I say you're a weirdo is I was thinking this lately. I have started out as an engineer. I taught middle school. I've been a professor. And for many years, I've been working two or three jobs at once. This is the fourth company I've founded. And while I was working full-time as a professor, I was running a consulting company. And you're the same way. I mean, listen, you're a teacher, and then you're teaching graduate school, and then you founded a nonprofit, you founded a startup. And, you know, Maria's the same way. She started out in journalism, and she's CEO of our company, and she's written a book. Why do you think that some people are like that? And then you have other people who sometimes I envy, that they go to work and they work for 8 hours and they come home and they watch TV and play in the rec basketball league.
Yeah.
What's up with that?
You know, it's a great question. It's such an insightful one. And I've asked myself the same thing. I've had close friends ask me before, why don't you just take teaching and use it as a lifestyle career? And I don't know why I have that internal drive to constantly learn. I know that I have a lot to continue and always will to grow into. I think I've chosen or have a combination of choosing and just an internal, what seems to be innate passion for, again, addressing equity issues and going about that through trying to personalize and make education more meaningful to individual students. And I don't ever see that as a achievable goal. Not impossible in a discouraging sense, but there's always lessons to be learned, people to collaborate with like yourselves that inspire and challenge me and move me in new and different directions. So I don't know, maybe it's just my temperament, but I never feel satisfied just standing still, so to speak.
We'll be right back.
Did you know that kids on average lose 2.5 months of math skills over the summer? That means that when they go back to school this fall, it's almost like everything they learned in math since mid-March never happened. Seventh Generation Games can help. Combining adventure gaming and math, our games are the perfect way to keep kids' math skills up to date. It's not flashcards or worksheets, but 3D video games and engaging apps that kids actually want to play, even when they're on summer break. Check us out at 7GenerationGames.com.
Welcome back to More Than Ordinary, presented by 7Generation Games, where we do the drop right there. Just remind you that you should check out 7Generation Games by us. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm Anne-Marie DeMars, and I'm also reminding you to check out 7Generation Games because if you don't have somebody like Rich hanging around to educate you personally and provide you micro badges, here's one thing that you could get. You could play our games and get a certificate showing that at least you had mastered standards in multiplication, division, fractions. Is that a micro credential?
We'll count it as such. Absolutely.
And that is Rich Dixon, if somehow you missed the first half of the podcast, if you weren't paying attention. So, Maria, you had a question for Rich about startups?
Yeah, well, we had talked a little bit about your background. And one of the things is you'd left teaching, done, you know, nonprofit, then started a company, I guess. And through that is how you got into the badges. We've talked about that. But I want to talk about, and as this maybe sounds negative to some people, but the end. Because we were talking about how it's not necessarily a negative thing. So I guess talk a little bit about your startup experience and we'll run through there because we're talking about there's not just fail or unicorn.
Yeah, I think that's such an insightful question and I really appreciate it. At least in my journey over 5 years of co-launching a company, seeing it grow and start to get traction and be able to bring something new to market that hadn't been done at least quite in the unique format that we were doing, which specifically was micro-credentials that were associated with formal university credit through an accredited WASC accredited or regional accreditation agency. And being able to get the excitement around that and grow and hire staff and have that hope that maybe by some way we might be able to grow this thing and actually be successful, given the high rate of failure, of course, within startups and knowing that that was an ever-present reality. We got to a point where we grew the company and started to plateau a bit around year four. And we knew we needed to start bringing in marketing and sales in order to really punch through our current capacity and grow. And we began to talk with other outside investors, VC funders, companies that were interested in acquisitions. And we found a partner. And we were very close, very, very close up until the last, literally last days before that deal fell apart. And we made a very difficult decision. Our majority investor, who had been very, very kind and generous to us, had a meeting with us and we sat down and we thought through the possibilities of growing or plateauing out and stagnating. And we decided that the stagnation route just wasn't feasible and wasn't a wise use of his money or any of our time. So we made a really hard decision to pull the plug. And a number of different people have approached me and had a very wonderful and empathetic response visually, one that almost I would equate to when you might lose someone close to you, kind of, I'm sorry, there's condolences, I'm sure you're going through grief. And while all of that is true in terms of the feelings of grief, there's a real sense of appreciation that I felt right away. Sadness for sure, but appreciation that that 5-year journey allowed us to create something new that we didn't think was necessarily a given that we would get that far. I certainly formed a team that allowed us to, as a group, achieve things that none of us could do on our own. Find new appreciation, I think, for the members of the team and just the amazing things that each individual brought to the team. And I didn't feel like it was a failure. It could be deemed that for sure. Traditional eyes that look about success or failure on whether or not a startup lives through acquisition and a huge big payday and all that kind of good stuff. We never hit that. But what we did do is we were able to engage in a market, bring something new to the table. We were able to win an award early on, a small award, recognizing the uniqueness of the work. And that was really validating that we had something to provide, in this case, to other educators, since it was online professional development, where accomplishments were acknowledged with digital badges. And there were a lot of transferable lessons that all of us have taken with us into our new jobs. And I'm happy to report that everyone was able to land on their feet in a relatively swift manner. And I don't know. I think for me, learning lessons that are transferable, there's something invaluable about that. And we're all still great close friends and we still all respect each other. And so for me, there's a lot of elements of success within that.
Well, we had someone on the podcast who you might think at first has a little bit different background than yourself. She's a professional wrestler, Shayna Baszler, and she also talked about having a college degree in, I think, Christian adolescent counseling. And she said that even though you wouldn't think that that's something that you would need in the WWE, that she considered every experience she had as equity, that when you either build a company or you get a college degree or you're, you know, on a TV show or whatever it is, that she says you look at that as equity in yourself, that you now have those skills. And even if you go away and you do something else, the ability you learn to communicate, or like you said, you know, the business practices, the connections you made, all of those things are part of the equity that you take with yourself moving forward.
Yeah, that's a great, great example and a great story.
Oh, we had another question about that. So when you kind of wrapped up your company, it seemed to me like it was a great idea when you were talking about, oh, we're going to do these digital badges for faculty. I thought this was a great idea.
Yeah.
And the other thing I've heard people talk about when they left a company, we did this startup, we did it for 2 or 3 years, it didn't have a successful exit, is that they had the greatest time doing it, that they look back and those were some of the most successful years in their life in terms of waking up every day and looking forward to the work they're doing and never dreading that, oh my God, I've got to go sit in this cubicle. Was that kind of what you had?
Absolutely. I think for so many different reasons, it's great to have a team where everyone, because you're so small and you have this sense of purpose and it's a survival mentality and you're rallying around each other to be able to build a culture where there's trust, people were present, collaborative, and all shooting in the same direction and feeling like, hey, we pulled this off. In other words, the we as a team was at the forefront, was really rewarding. And getting up, working on weekends, working late at night, doing lots of travel, waking up early, all of those kinds of things were completely worth the sacrifices because of the incredible opportunities to achieve things, again, that none of us could have done on our own and probably couldn't have done under a traditional organizational structure. Because again, it's a young company, you know, you're fighting for every day, every week survival as you're starting to grow. And I think when you have the right team and the right people together, some of the magic that you just alluded to emerges.
We'll be right back.
You know how sometimes you have an idea of how you want something done? Like how you would have your living room decorated, your closet organized, or whatever. But you just haven't had the time to get around to it because the way it is right now is passable and it works. But in the back of your head, you know it could be better someday. Well, for Spirit Lake the Game, someday is today. At 7 Generation Games, we've rolled out a major update of our very first game. We've kept the parts that were already great and enhanced those areas where we saw potential for enhancements to give you a new version of the game that we know kids will love even more than the original. If you already have Spirit Lake, check your email for the update notification. If you don't have Spirit Lake, well, what are you waiting for? Get it today. It's time for the third segment of our podcast where we ask our guests to give us a tip. And the tip can be about anything. It can be about teaching or running a startup or, you know, advice you give your daughter. Anything that you think is important, advice you either wish you'd knew or you find yourself giving a lot. What is one tip you have for the More Than Ordinary listeners?
If I were to go back 25 years ago when I was starting teaching, and something that I grappled with a lot during startup life was that feeling of, I don't really have all the answers. And I think as a school teacher, a lot of times we were trained, at least in my area of the world where I was trained in Southern California at the time, there's an emphasis on really being that wise guide who more or less had the answers and could help guide students to where they needed to be. And going into a startup environment, those rules don't apply at all, at least my experience. And we have experience that's important that helps us, but waking up each day and thinking that I knew exactly what was going to happen, being assured that I could execute upon those goals, and having a very predictable life was certainly out the window. I thrive in that, but I know that not everybody does. Some people like to have a more predictable life. So I think for me, a nugget of wisdom that I learned for myself was the true humility of, if you allow me to say it, failing or learning through maybe missteps as we grew different aspects of the organization. Nothing major, but just for example, none of us really had a marketing background. We've been marketed to our whole life, but what we thought might work early on didn't really. And so we learned some good lessons along the way. And because we explicitly talked about failures, not achieving the goals that we originally thought for that particular small initiative, it allowed us to be humble and build a level of trust. And so I guess maybe the bigger nugget is having great people around, being able to be transparent and honest with self and with others helps create the kind of culture, at least for me, that I love and thrive in when I'm working and hopefully in the rest of my life as well. And if I can say this, and I hope it's not too provocative, I think our nation and our country could all benefit all of us, certainly myself, in a good dose of humility and skills in listening and appreciating others.
Well, I think that's great advice that we all need to take to heart. So that's all we have for today. I just wanted to thank you a lot for taking time out of your schedule. I know you're on to your next chapter and a new career. And so I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. And I hope everybody is now eager to go out and learn about micro badges. If they wanted to find out more, is there a website or someplace that you mentioned LRNG? Is there anywhere else that you'd recommend they follow you? Or
yeah, there's a couple different areas. If you are particularly interested in digital badges in K-12 education, even if you're in higher ed, this would work as well. Every Monday at 3:30 p.m. Pacific time, there is a Twitter chat, if you're into Twitter, using the hashtag BadgeChatK12, all one word, hashtag BadgeChatK12. There is also a collection of resources that I will share with you. Maybe they could be posted in the show notes.
Yes, I'll do that.
That will allow a quick overview. A friend of mine calls it a dumpster dive of treasures. There's a planning guide. There are case studies. There are resources, all free for you to help you get started. And I will share those as well. And it's shared on a site called Padlet and freely accessible to use and repurpose under a Creative Commons license.
Perfect. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the More Than Ordinary podcast.
For more information, please go to our website, 7GenerationGames.com. And that's 7 as in the number 7, GenerationGames.com.
If you'd like to learn more about math and history, or increase your vocabulary while at the same time having fun, you can purchase our games at 7GenerationGames.com/buy.
You can also donate and help a much-deserving student.
And as always, please tell a friend and don't forget to rate us on iTunes.
It's never too late to be more than ordinary.